If you're ready, Dr. Locke, we'd love to hear how it's going. So
okay. So you have audio now? You can hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. Well, thanks. Sorry for the delay. We're getting used to this new technology. So I wanted to start just with the my notes clear here. So I would describe this last month as something that, like no other that we have experienced in public health in recent history. And it literally started almost exactly a month ago. So on Friday, February 28th, is when the CDC and the FDA lifted the restrictions on state public health labs to do testing. And that's when we started doing testing here in Washington State. And what we discovered almost immediately was that the coronavirus was widespread in Western Washington, that it had probably been circulating for at least 6 weeks, and that things like a nursing home outbreak that was going on in Kirkland, that it was thought to be due to influenza, was in fact due to coronavirus. So as we've all seen, a number of things have taken place in the last month. At the middle of the month, the governor closed all the schools and started some social distancing kind of strategies. These have intensified with each passing week. And now, as of 1 week ago, on the 23rd, we have a full isolated home, what's known as the Stay Home, Stay Healthy initiative, and this, as I'll try to explain, is something I'll try to explain the rationale behind this and why we're cautiously optimistic that it's starting to work here in Washington State. So first, with the statistics that so as of this morning, what's going on in the U.S. is there's almost 1,000 or 123,000 cases of coronavirus have been diagnosed, and of these, 2,112 have died. That's nationwide. Here in Washington State, where we have one of the higher testing levels in the United States because we started first, as of this morning, 4,896 tests have been done, and our fatality rate here in Washington State is 195. And most of those have occurred in the I-5 corridor. And of these tests, this represents the positives out of over 65,000 tests that have been done here in Washington State. So about 7.5% of Washington State tests for COVID-19 have been positive. Here in Jefferson County, we've had 12 positives so far that we've completed investigations on. I can tell you there's going to be two more today that will be added to the list that we're just starting investigations on. And that's out of 306 that were negative. And we have over 150 that are still pending. So we're running around 4% of the tests that we've gotten back are showing up positive. So what I'd like to go through with the board a bit is the strategy. And how we're trying to slow the spread of the virus in the state. That's the overwhelming priority in this, because we know that we can't stop this from spreading. We don't have an effective vaccine. We don't have any effective antiviral medications. So So our strategy is to slow it and to protect those who are most at risk of complications. And the first strategy we use is social distancing, or what people are now starting to call physical distancing. And this literally means keeping 6 feet or more away from anyone else, no crowds, no gatherings, other than really household gatherings. So the only people that should be getting together are the people who live together, or people who are in these essential work kind of categories. This is especially important for high-risk populations. So those over 60, those with chronic medical conditions, women who are pregnant, they need to isolate as much as is possible for them. And that means no visits from grandchildren or friends or people who might have been moving around in the community and might have the infection without even knowing it. The other strategy that is and has been very important is what's often called respiratory etiquette. And this is the whole cover your cough, cough into your sleeve, cough into tissue, and then throw that tissue away and wash your hands afterwards. And the reason this is so important is this is what contaminates the environment. People cough and sneeze for all kinds of reasons. People have allergies. People have asthma. But it can also be one of the early signs of COVID-19. And so the more we prevent this contamination of the environment by coughing out infectious droplets, the less likely other people are to get it. We've been emphasizing this for a long time, but I can't emphasize it too much, and that is the whole stay at home if you're sick kind of strategy. I'll be sending out guidelines for businesses this week that will go into that in greater detail, and we already have those protocols in effect in a lot of places where literally employees are having their temperature taken every day before they enter buildings. People are encouraged to take their temperature the night before. If you have any signs of illness whatsoever, it's critically important that you stay home, because one thing we know about the coronavirus infection is that it can be contagious for several days before you develop symptoms. So timing is of the essence. This also applies for people who are in quarantine. Is at the very first signs of illness, they have to strictly isolate themselves and call their healthcare providers, and we'll arrange for testing. Another important strategy is hand washing and sanitizing, washing or sanitizing your hands. And the reason for this is that we think this may be a major route of contagion. It's not just the coughing, but it's that environments get contaminated, and the coronavirus is a hardy virus. It can survive on environmental surfaces from anywhere from hours to days. So people who are shedding the virus and may not even be sick are depositing it on environmental surfaces. Other people touch those and then get them into their bodies by touching, as we're all familiar, eyes, nose, or mouth, or eating food with your hand. And then finally, because of that contamination that's occurring in our environments, especially on high-touch surfaces, it's important to be disinfecting these surfaces. All of those things make a difference, and all of them work to do what I think everyone's familiar with now, this strategy of flattening the curve. And a lot of this has to do with preventing a surge in healthcare needs that would overwhelm our system. As we look at that surge, it's going to come in two forms. As we see more and more cases, Most of them will be able to be managed at home, but people need a home care plan. They need to expect to have to take care of family and maybe relatives who become ill, but are not so ill that they need hospitalization. This may be as many as 80% of people who get this virus. And then somewhere around 20%, 15 to 20%, we now project are going to need hospitalization. Most of them for oxygen therapy. But some will go into respiratory failure and need ventilators. And it's critically important that we keep this number as low as possible, because here in a rural community, we have very few ventilators. And this underscores the importance of high-risk populations staying isolated, because they're the ones that are most likely to develop the worst complications and need ventilators. So what this really is, as is this illness moves through the community, it's going to be a challenge to the entire community. Neighbors need to get to know each other. If they don't, make contact and have a plan. You know, if you get sick, you're going to need to rely on friends and family and community to help you through the illness. Of course, we also need to be maintaining all these essential services, healthcare workers, emergency medical systems. And I would ask people who are viewing this to if you call 911 for what we're calling a COVID-like illness, so someone who has a known exposure to a confirmed case, someone who is has symptoms, essentially fever and respiratory symptoms, you should tell 911 that's what you're calling for, that you're having a respiratory infection related emergency, because they can use that information to better protect themselves when they come and render emergency services. We need to maintain public safety personnel, essential government, water and power, and food services, of course, are open. And I want to assure people there are and there will not be any food shortages. The United States has an extraordinary supply of food and a system to distribute it. So that's not a feature of this emergency. People don't have to hoard food. They don't need months and months of food supplies. The stores will remain open and the stores will remain stocked. Ultimately, one of the biggest challenges we're all going to face is we need to learn a new way of living in this reality of a infectious respiratory disease that can have severe complications moving through communities for months on end. And the way I'm trying to express this to people is you have to understand how these diseases are transmitted, because that's how you look at your daily activities and decide how to modify them. And but there's three potential ways that the novel coronavirus can spread. One is by droplet transmission. We think that's a major pathway, and that's when you cough or sneeze. Tiny droplets are expelled, and they fall to the ground or environmental surfaces quickly. So if you're very close to someone, you can inhale those droplets. It may be that some people, when they're singing or shouting, that droplets come out at those times too. So it may not just be coughing. When those droplets settle, or if people get them on their hands, they get spread around. And we're thinking more and more that contact spread is a major source of spread, especially when people are asymptomatic. So that just underscores the fact that we have to regard all surfaces that other people have touched as potentially infectious. And then there's airborne transmission, and this is one of the kind of controversies of this. We know there's airborne transmission in very unique circumstances, in hospital intensive care units, when people are on ventilators or being intubated, when there's a lot of mechanical processes that are making aerosols out of secretions. We know this can potentially happen in dental offices, where they use a lot of high-speed equipment, and so we're re-engineering the infection control practices in dental offices. And there's these open questions. Some people feel that aerosol spread may be involved in when people cough or when droplets are formed. And there was just a big review of this, all the evidence of it, that came out on Friday from the World Health Organization. And they've essentially concluded, based on what we know now, there is not significant aerosol spread from coughing or sneezing. It almost exclusively has to do with these mechanical processes. But this is not something we're 100% sure of. One of the problems and the challenges of a novel coronavirus infection like this is that we're learning new things every day, and there's certain things that are just plain unknown. We don't know, for instance, if there's transmission like some other intestinal infection viruses, what we call fecal-oral transfer, things that occurs with hepatitis A and with norovirus. The evidence does not support this, but people are looking at it very intensely, because that would also explain some of this transmission among people from people who don't have symptoms. So just a few other things I'd like to touch on before we go into questions, and that is grocery stores. We have to learn a new way of going to grocery stores, and this is something that we're trying to perfect day by day. People will see different practices in grocery stores as they adjust to these new realities. First and foremost, we want to avoid crowding. We don't want everyone going to grocery stores at the same time. And the stores are doing a lot of things to try to prevent this. They're having special hours for high-risk populations. But each of us as community members have to take responsibility too. You know, if we go to a grocery store and that grocery store looks crowded, we should not go in there. We should wait. We should go at a different time. It's, you know, adding one more person to a crowded store just makes the situation worse. Within the stores, we need to maintain our distance. The 6 foot is really important, because that's all about if a person should suddenly cough or sneeze, that's the danger zone around each person. It's increasingly going to be important to adopt hand washing or sanitizing processes specific to grocery stores. So the ideal is to wash your hands or sanitize them when you first go in, and that's to protect the store. That's to clean your hands so the things you touch in the store are not contaminated with whatever's on your hands. And then when you leave the store, to wash your hands or sanitize them again, and that's to protect you against anything you might have picked up when you touched objects that other people might have touched. So stores are setting up hand washing stations. People should bring hand sanitizer in small bottles if they have it to use. But that needs to be a new way of life for us all. It's important that people minimize their handling of things. You know, this is not an era where you want to pick through every piece of fruit and find the perfect one. Anything you touch, you should take. in terms of products, so that the less people handle things, the better. And while in the store, after you touch the first thing, you should regard your hands as being contaminated. And at no time touch your eyes, nose, or mouth, because that you could pick up an infection that way. And then a problem we're seeing too, and it's an understandable one. People are cut off from their normal forms of socialization. And so it's a natural thing to want to do that in stores where you see people you know. But you have to be very careful with that. To the extent that you see people you know, you should keep 6 feet away from them. And people should not deliberately go to stores so they can socialize. That just makes things worse. It's not going to be this way forever, but it is that way right now. And then I just wanted to mention with food services, restaurants are closed, of course, to people eating inside the restaurant. But many of them, and we hope more and more, will keep their kitchens open and make takeout food. And we really encourage people to take advantage of that, to order takeout, to have home delivery. We think that food produced in restaurants is very safe, actually. Restaurants use very stringent public health practices, much more stringent than people use in their own kitchens, actually. So we encourage takeout. It helps keep these businesses in business. But people who are going to the restaurants to pick up the food themselves need to be careful not to congregate at the entrance or at the pickup spot. You know, keep your 6 foot distance. And then finally, I just want to mention how important it is to for all these other activities in the community, artists and all the things that we associate with culture and quality of life. Those things have all been shut down, and the things that we want to remain in our community when these restrictions are lifted, we have to support now. So I encourage anyone who's still working, who has an income, who has comfortable retirement income, now is the time to support the arts in any way you can. I'm just going to talk a bit about what the future looks like under these kind of restrictions. And we're thinking at this time that the social distancing kind of strategies will stay in place for most, if not all, of the month of April. That we see signs that this is working. But premature relaxation of these standards could be a disaster. We could end up just going back to square one and having to do it all over again. And in this strategy, this week is absolutely crucial. This is the week that we sort of flush the system of undiagnosed cases. So people who have become infected before the real stringent social distancing took effect, they're actually already starting to get ill, and they should get better by the end of this week. So they should be over their illness after about 14 days, sometimes less, sometimes within 7 days. And those who are not going to get better on their own, they should start showing up in the hospital about 2 weeks after exposure. So that's what we're really looking for in this coming week. Some of the good news is that the surge in medical demand that we were thinking might start as early as the first week in April, that's not happening in the I-5 corridor. Is that what we're doing is working, and it's starting to flatten the curve. We're not as confident in rural areas as to what's going on. And we have some reports that people are not taking this as seriously in rural areas as they are in the urban areas. And so it's critically important that we all take it seriously. The But here in the Pacific Northwest, we were ground zero of this. We were the place it first started. And actually, we were the ones that reacted the most aggressively in terms of testing and in terms of social distancing. And we're the ones that, in the United States, Washington State is showing more response than anywhere else. And part of it is timing, but part of it is I think we're doing the right things, and we have to keep them up. So I just say that this is going to be with us for some time. We think that the most optimistic estimates are this will be circulating in communities for at least 3 months, and to some degree probably much longer. And the only thing that will really stop it ultimately is if a vaccine is developed or some kind of effective antiviral medication, or the most ancient way of all has been throughout human history, and that is more and more people get it, more and more people develop immunity, and gradually the momentum of the epidemic stops. There just aren't enough people left who are susceptible to sustain an outbreak. That's how it's always been in human history, and that's very likely how this pandemic will play out. And I just remind people, you know, despite all the grim news, the best evidence we have is over 99% of people who get this infection will survive it. You look at the confirmed cases and the what we call the case fatality rate, and that's looking scary, but that doesn't represent the true number of people infected. We think way more people are infected and are recovering from it than the statistics show us. And in this next month, we're hoping to get a test online where we can start to measure that. You know, the people who we can start to measure the immunity in the population and see if that's increasing. So with that, thank you for sitting through that very long presentation of this. But are there any questions I might be able to answer?
Dr. Lockhart, Philip Morley. And one of the things you talked about was calling 911. I just wanted to confirm. You're not suggesting that everybody who, or let me ask the question, are you suggesting, it may have sounded that you were suggesting that anybody who knows they've been exposed and has any symptoms of COVID call 911? Or are you saying that if they need emergent care and they call 911, they should identify that they've been COVID exposed? Could you clarify?
Yes, thank you. It's very much the latter. No one should call 911 unless they have an emergency. In this pandemic, people can develop respiratory distress. They can get sicker and sicker, and they can find that they're having trouble breathing, and that it's so severe that they feel that they're. They can't use a family member to get them to a healthcare setting, so they call 911. And we've gotten requests from emergency service providers. You know, it would help them if they knew the status of people. They knew whether they were being called for a respiratory emergency or a heart attack or a stroke, those kind of things. So we encourage people to share that information with emergency medical providers. They will, of course, respond to the emergency, but they will use special protective equipment, which has been very short supply. I didn't cover that, but that's still a huge problem. You know, we now have this global demand for personal protective equipment that the manufacturers just can't keep up with. So we're having to do extreme conservation. EMS workers, 911 responders can't wear personal protective equipment to every call because there just isn't enough equipment to support that. So that's why I was saying that. But But people who are developing symptoms of COVID-like disease, they should call their healthcare providers, not 911. And they should call the nurse hotline if they want to get tested.
Thanks, Dr. Locke. Commissioner Sullivan, do you have any questions?
Okay. Well, let's see. I've been getting questions about things like Airbnb. Should those be open? Or, our gun club is a recreational facility, so as long as they use the appropriate distancing, is that okay, even though it's not active recreation?
Part of it is a legal question, and that is to say what falls legally under the governor's order. Because the governor, under his very broad authority, has closed a number of events businesses. I would regard things like gun clubs. I would regard this. My personal view is that is a non-essential service, and it's something that is in fact recreational. And it involves risk. You know, if people are in close proximity or if they're touching surfaces that other people have touched, there is increased risk of exposure there. And the idea of this, this is not to in any way punish gun enthusiasts. It's to all activities that involve people getting together and doing things they enjoy doing. Those need to be put on hold. Until we're through the critical stage of this. So whether those are open or not, legally, I would discourage people from going to them. Airbnbs, if they're not essential accommodations for people, I would discourage those from being in operation too. I don't think this is a time that anyone should be seeing this as a vacation or recreation. But many of these accommodations, hotels, motels, they're serving a very important function. There are public safety and EMS workers who feel that their exposure level is so high, they don't want to go home to their families. And so they're staying in motels. And that's a reasonable precaution to take. There are exchange students who have been sent home from other countries who are in 2-week quarantine, and they can't go home because they have high-risk individuals, parents or grandparents in this home, so they're staying in hotels or motels for this 2-week quarantine. So we can't and we don't want to close all of these what we call transient accommodations. Are the category they fall into, because they provide some very important functions, for people who are not close to home or for various reasons feel it's unsafe to return home because they're in such a high-risk exposure category. But I think Airbnbs probably don't fall into that category. And their legal status is something I just don't know, actually.
Dr. Locke, this is Philip Morley. Would like to revisit the gun club and to say that, number one, it's not open to the general public at this point, just members. Number two, they're not allowing any congregation in the shooting. It's individual shooting. They're spacing the shooting positions. And they also have cleaning protocols in place, we understand. We've been in contact with them about this. The argument potentially for this is, as a form of recreation, it's good for mental health. It's a calming thing that helps people reduce their stress in that you have to slow down your breathing, concentrate on the target. It takes your minds off your troubles. They discontinued some weeks ago any competitions that would be create a congregation, and it's just open to their members, and they're ensuring social distancing. Understanding that, do you have the same concerns?
I see the rationale for it, and the psychology of this is extremely important, so I would not want to minimize that at all. And ultimately, I think it comes down to a legal question. If it's legal for them to be open, then it's their right to do that. You know, it's only businesses and activities that are strictly prohibited under the governor's order should be closed. And then it becomes up to members. And I'm glad to hear that they're taking the risk seriously, and everyone should. That gets together, and the risk can be managed. You know, down the road, we're going to be opening more and more things, but the practices are going to be different, and they're going to involve distancing and disinfection and special protocols, because you know we want people to do the things that give meaning to their life and are, as you say, are calming and. Give people a sense of purpose. And for that reason, too, we're encouraging people to get exercise, to go out walking, to get outdoors. You know, it's springtime in Washington State. But to do it in a way that's safe for them and safe for the community. And that means keeping their distance from other people that are not members of their household.
Along those lines, Jefferson County parks remain open, while a number of other passive recreational facilities have been closed. However, we are closing playgrounds, things like that have been closed and are posted as closed because that involves touch and congregation of kids. We don't want that, but to allow people to be walking, enjoying the outdoors, we are keeping our parks open.
Dr. Locke, in that same vein, I had a question about, I know the Port Townsend Farmers Market is set to open on April 4th and has worked with public health to come up with a plan that you know, creates enough personal space, the 6-foot space, and, you know, I think they're putting 10 feet between tents and everything. And a lot of our local farms are a real important part of our food security at the same time, not having access to the grocery stores all the time. And I was just, I guess, wondering if you had a stance on the farmers market being an appropriate place to get food.
Well, I think it is. I think it's a very healthy source of nutrition, and it's the keeping farmers markets open is the same rationale as keeping grocery stores open. Is people need access to food. I've noticed actually in the grocery stores, you know, we've been paying attention to what's going on there, and the things you see people taking huge amounts of are like canned goods and dried beans, and the produce aisles seem almost untouched, and I would encourage people to eat more produce. The foundation of good nutrition that helps your immune system stay strong. So we think that the farmers market can safely operate if they employ the same kinds of safety features that we're using in grocery stores. So again, with hand washing or hand sanitizing and social distancing, but the food itself is not dangerous. You can cook food. You can wash fresh fruit. We want to keep that part of the food chain operating, but it's going to have to be different than it's been in the past. You know, people don't want to crowd together. And people should not use that as an opportunity for close-in socialization. I realize how isolating this all is to people and how strong that human desire is to socialize. And it's not like you can't talk to people, but you have to talk to them at a distance. or you have to find new ways to connect to people over the telephone or audiovisual links or just ways that prevent people from transmitting infection.
Great. Thanks, Dr. Locke. Dave, did you have any other questions?
No, that discussion's really good. Thank you.
Can I follow up on the farmer's market question? Dr. Locke, any advice on handling of fresh produce that's not going to be cooked? Is there any indication that there are kind of cleaning protocols that could effectively kill the virus that could inadvertently be passed on at the farmer's market?
We think that fresh produce is probably very low risk for virus transmission in the first place, because it's the virus doesn't last forever on surfaces, and the more it's outdoors, the more it's exposed to sunlight and the drying conditions that are outdoors, the shorter the lifespan. You know, in some cases, you know, the lifespan of the virus may be minutes to hours outdoors. But the risk with produce is that other people may have touched it first. So that unwashed hands may have touched that produce. And so, yes, you can and you should wash off produce when you bring it home. And there are a number of food detergents that are used, the same things that people use to wash pesticide residue off of fresh food, you know, if they get it from commercial sources, is works, or just little bits, small amounts of dishwashing detergent. That's the best for say fruits or produce that has sort of a hard outer covering. You can wash it like you wash dishes, you know, just in soapy water and then rinse it in clean water. Things like lettuce, leafy vegetables, you can't do that, but you just use copious amounts of water. There's all kinds of diseases that are spread by food that we effectively control with by good washing of produce before you eat it. And the same things apply for coronavirus. Some of the things like norovirus are much more hardy than coronavirus.
Great, thank you.
Great. Do we have questions, Kate?
No, I'll just reiterate what Commissioner Sullivan mentioned, and that's we're getting a lot of feedback from the public and requests or demands, let's say, about prohibition, asking for prohibitions or closures, and I don't even think we have the authority to do that. I think you do, Dr. Locke, but I understand the concern that that if the only tool is an absolute closure, that's going to impact some housing, people with vulnerable housing situations of all sorts. But I do wonder if there are ways that we can finer tune accessibility here. I mean, we just had this weekend another case of vacation rentals filling up in desirable places here in Jefferson County. And that's, I mean, it's very discouraging to me that not everybody's getting the message to stay home. I keep saying what part of stay home is so hard to understand. So I'm curious, do you know of other communities that have found some tools to limit that kind of use versus absolute closure that would affect people unintentionally?
Well, we're looking at that all around the state, actually all around the country and the world. This is a problem, is people fleeing cities, going to rural areas and bringing the infection with them. So intensifying the spread to rural areas. It's not theoretical, it's real. We feel in this state it's best to do things in a statewide fashion. So if we're going to close farmers markets, we should close them statewide. You know, if we're going to somehow restrict vacation rentals, that we should do that statewide. Because if we do it in a piecemeal fashion, it just makes things worse. It starts getting people shifted, looking for the areas that are more or less restrictive and moving around for that basis. But we are revisiting these decisions literally day by day. And anything that we think is a significant preventable risk is a candidate for action. We hope that, and we do everything possible in public communication to encourage and incentivize people to do the right thing. It's of course natural for people to their first concern is themselves and their families, but they also have to factor in the community in that. And they can safely stay in the cities. They don't have to flee to vacation areas. And they have to realize that the systems, the healthcare systems in rural areas are very fragile. They're not as robust as in the urban areas. If they get sick, they're going to have a lot fewer options. So that's the other aspect of it, is people moving from their homes to rural areas are also putting an extra load on our healthcare system to take care of them if they get sick. And it contributes to the surge. So, there's a bunch of reasons to discourage it. And I think one of our challenges is to have a way to track it, to see if these sort of voluntary restrictions are really working. And if they're not, then I think sooner rather than later, we're going to have to go to restrictions that are not voluntary. And local health officers, we do not hesitate to use the authority if we think it will protect the community. It's just that we're trying to do it all together. My counterparts and Kitsap and Clallam County, we talk almost every day. And we have several scheduled phone calls every week just to kind of keep coordinating what we're doing. Dr. Turner in Kitsap County developed an excellent set of guidelines for businesses in terms of screening workers who are coming to work. And rather than reinvent that here in Jefferson County, we're just going to use a modification of Dr. Turner's protocol that we'll be putting out today for businesses.
Great.
Anything else, Kate?
No, nothing.
Okay. I just had one question. You know, it looks like we are starting to be effective in the state and flattening the curve a little bit. But of course, as we flatten it, the duration is going to extend, as I understand. So I guess I'm wondering, you know, April shot, I think everyone, you know, is pretty much acknowledges that. So assuming that we continue to be effective with this level of community mitigation, April, what do you see, you know, down the line if we really do flatten it as the, what can we unclench to? Opening non-essential businesses? I guess I'm just trying to understand some of the landscape in the short, midterm future.
Be curious, there's some more that as well.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's exactly what we should be working on now. We don't want to wait until May to start to develop this new way of doing business. And this is really this is something I am very much encouraging businesses and individuals to spend this month doing is educate yourself on infection control. Learn to be like a person that works in a hospital, where this is just a way of life, that there are all these infections that people bring into hospitals, and there's an art to preventing the spread of these infections from one person to the other. We have to move those practices out into the community. And the better job we do at that, the more we can open things up. You know, because almost all businesses, that at least those that don't involve close crowding of individuals can eventually be reopened in one capacity or another with these kind of practices that very effectively exclude sick workers, you know, at the earliest sign of illness, and where hand washing is just a way of life. You know, people never contaminate surfaces, they never inoculate themselves by touching something and then touching their face, and disinfection, you know, not of unnecessary areas. You know, some people are disinfecting every square inch of their house, and they don't really need to do that. It's just the stuff that you touch. So now's the time to do that. And there's some extraordinary information resources. I was going to mention that Department of Health extensively revamped their web page with the help of Microsoft. It went live today finally. We were expecting it over the weekend. It just has this extraordinary detail of what's going on and what the impact of all the different interventions is. And that will, it's called their dashboard program. That will be available in real time. And there's just this growing list of educational resources for all these different businesses and activities, you know, what you should do to prevent infection in your setting, and people should really be reading that and taking advantage of this opportunity, because that's what's going to make it safe to reopen things. You know, the social distancing or what we call the community mitigations, the 13 community mitigations, those we'll be able to back off on some of them in time. You know, no one's thinking that this is going to be 3 to 6 months of what's going on right now. But we have to control the rate of transmission. We have to slow it to the point that we can manage it in our healthcare system, because otherwise the effects are can just be disastrous. It's what's playing out in New York right now. And that's going to be a tragedy of it's almost incomprehensible for people to understand what that's like when you're working in a hospital and you have three people that need a ventilator and you only have one ventilator for those three people. That is the thing you hope to never face as a healthcare practitioner, but they're going to have to face every day. We don't want that to happen in the Pacific Northwest, and that's why we're taking these extraordinary efforts to prevent it from happening, both regionally and here in Jefferson County. I strongly believe we can do this. I think we're seeing the early signs of it, but we are going to. This is in our community. This is circulating in the community. It's being transmitted person to person in Jefferson County. And we have to take that seriously.
Greg, this is Philip. Why don't we let Willie Bentz say a few things? He's going to need to leave at 11.
Oh, yeah. Go ahead, Willie. Yeah, take us to the show.
Thank you. I'll just give you a quick update on part of the EOC and what we're focusing on. First off, Dr. Locke mentioned the shortage of PPE, and that's something that we're really trying hard to get additional personal protective equipment into the county for our healthcare workers and first responders. But you know, like we talk a lot after a potential large Cascadia earthquake, and a lot of the resources are going to be directed to the metro areas first, and then we're going to be kind of a secondary priority given our lack of population here. We're experiencing that about 1,000 times over because this is a global pandemic. So it's not just the Pacific Northwest. It's not just our country. It's everywhere fighting for these resources. So we're having some trouble getting some resources into a rural community like ours. We're mostly working through the State Emergency Operations Center. They have a team of public health experts reviewing all requests for PPE from across the state, and then basically prioritizing those resources accordingly based on number of positive cases, their risk profile, population, all that kind of fun stuff. So we haven't gotten any PPE from the state yet, but we're really hoping to get some this week. We should know here in the next day or two what our delivery is supposed to be looking like. Our friends over at County Public Health have a warehouse basically cleared out and at the ready to accept what's hopefully going to be multiple pallets worth of PPE that we can deliver to the hospital, to the fire departments, to the law enforcement, et cetera. I am happy to say, though, that through that PPE, through that resource request process, we are getting two additional ventilators into the county. Dr. Locke mentioned how that's a very essential priority. So we have one both for patient transport for EMS, and then an ICU ventilator coming to the hospital. The order was placed just last week, and so we're hoping to see those here in our community this week. Other than that, we're working with vendors from basically anywhere we can find. But again, like everyone else, whenever we do find a vendor that potentially has a supply, it's gone before we're even able to pick up the phone. So we're exploring all of our options, but at this point, working through the state EOC, working through that large logistics apparatus is our best bet. Other than PPE, a couple of the other major things we're working on, like Dr. Locke mentioned that SIRS, he researched, he's talked about the need to flatten the curve. We're really trying to work to build up our capacity to handle whatever surge we see. One of those ways is working on an isolation and quarantine facility for our transient population who may not be able to isolate or quarantine on their own given their very limited resources, as well as a facility for what's called kind of step-down care. So when someone's discharged from the hospital, they don't require medical care anymore, but they're not quite ready to go home. They require some level of basically non-medical observation. We're working on a facility for that as well to kind of ease the strain on Jefferson Healthcare and really enable them to get people out of the hospital as soon as they possibly can so they can take care of those folks who need it a little bit more urgently. On that project, we're working with OLECAP, they've been just absolute rock stars, and I'm really hoping to take the lead on that particular facility. Other than that, also working with Jefferson Healthcare to expand surge capacity. They're focusing internally on getting basically as many beds available at their facility as possible. We're working on planning an alternate care facility or kind of a field hospital to be able to take additional patients outside of their traditional facility as well. So we have a team of EOC volunteers. One's a retired naval surgeon. Another has worked in the military in a field hospital setting before. Another is a retired Marine, former planner there. So they're working on identifying facilities, identifying external resources, seeing what FEMA, the state, maybe our partnering counties have to offer, and then again, expanding kind of that medical capacity. I do hate to say it, we're also looking at expanding morgue capacity because even though Dr. Locke did say that there's a 1% or less fatality rate, there's still maybe the possibility that this does test our capacity locally to be able to handle fatalities. So the prosecuting attorney / coroner's office is looking at making some modifications to a facility to be able to potentially handle that worst-case scenario. Unfortunately, though, like Dr. Locke said, we are doing a really excellent job at flattening the curve, kind of obeying these protective measures. But really, part of our job here at the EOC is to identify kind of the worst-case scenario and start planning appropriately. So we're looking a little bit farther out and planning for that. Last but certainly not least, we're also working with the community on ways they can help. If you go to our website, jeffcoeoc.org, there's some instructions there if you want to know how to sew and then donate masks. There's some information there for how you can help out. I do have to stress those masks are not for healthcare providers yet. We're waiting to agree upon a standard that's going to work for our partners in healthcare as well as EMS. The masks that you make will be for at-risk community members, which is still a dire need. So that way the medical-grade mask can actually go to the healthcare providers, and then community members can use these masks. Also, folks are asking about volunteering. You can go to our website or to OLECAP's website to put your name in the ring as a potential volunteer. We at DEM are looking for those with a particular background, whether you were previous law enforcement, a retired EMT, paramedic, nurse, or doctor. There's a form you can fill out to sign up as a volunteer with us. Or if you just want to learn how to help more generally, maybe at any potential shelter or help deliver meals, you can sign up with OLECAP. Last but not least, though, I do want to stress that the best way you can help, rather than go through, I hate to say it, especially with my boss sitting on this call, the bureaucracy of the EOC or county government, the absolute best thing you can do is just, you know, go and connect with your neighbors. We work a lot with Local 2020's NPREP program, that's Neighborhood Preparedness, which talked about, you know, help neighbors helping neighbors during a large earthquake or maybe a winter storm. This requires obviously a little bit more distance and a few more kind of precautions, but really the best thing you can do is check in with your neighborhood, check in with your neighbors, especially if you know someone who might be a little bit older, might have some mobility issues, might not be able to care for themselves. Just go ahead and check in with them, see if they need help. There are a lot of community groups on Nextdoor, on Facebook, who are doing that kind of thing as well. So search out and find those and see if you can offer some help that way. Again, if you want to get involved on a higher level, connect with OLECAP, connect with us at the EOC. If you don't have neighbors or you don't feel comfortable asking for help from anyone in your immediate circle, on OLECAP's website, there is a form that you can fill out to ask for help that way as well. So don't hesitate to reach out. But we're seeing a lot of kind of organic good popping up in these organized neighborhoods, and these organized neighborhoods, not through NPREP, but just kind of coming together and bonding while maintaining proper distancing during these times. So we're really encouraging a lot of that. But if you want more information, obviously jeffcoeoc.org. We can certainly use some more help that way.
Great, thanks. I have a question for you. And I'm not sure if you're the right person, but with the pretty substantial stimulus package from the feds over this past week, I know a lot of small businesses are probably starting to try to navigate the SBA's grants and loans and everything. And is it our EDC, or is there a local agency that people can go to for help that you're aware of in navigating that?
So we're working with the Chamber of Commerce to try to put together some outreach and some education and some training on exactly that, on how to navigate that SBA process, how to really navigate this situation as a whole, never mind all the paperwork and the confusing financial stuff. Part of the difficulty in putting that together is with FEMA and the Stafford Act funding that comes with a nationally declared emergency, that is subject to change with each major disaster depending on the needs, and it's already changed pretty substantially over the course of this event as well. So our finance section is working overtime, just trying to understand the resources that are out there. But then we'll be working with the chamber to, again, put together some more information, put together hopefully some I don't want to say hands-on training, but you guys know what I'm talking about, to help folks navigate that whole system. But in the meantime, if they do have any specific questions, you can contact us at jcdem@co.jefferson.wa.us, and we can direct you to the right place.